Support for the Sound ID.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Distill Brewery is banking on its sour ales for future growth as it opens its new facility in North Normal. But the company's Joe DeTroia says it's hard to say how long the public will want to keep quaffing a given style of beer.
Depending on the style, it might last a decade, it might last a couple of years, it might be one of those in-betweeners. It might even last longer than that. The IPAs, I think a lot of people thought they weren't going to last as long as they have.
More on the trends in craft brewing, plus mats for the homeless, Sgt. Pepper hits an anniversary, and a preview of what to expect tonight at a session on immigration in the Twin Cities. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
This podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Distill Brewery's new facility has its grand opening Saturday in North Normal, north of Menards. The $14 million, 47,000 square foot brewing facility also has a beer hall, an outdoor patio, and room to build more as needed. Growth in craft brewing has begun to slow in the U.S. as small brewers have proliferated and large brewers have started to buy the regional-sized craft operations. Growth in craft brewing last year was 6%. Compared to 18% the year before last and double-digit growth each year in the last decade. Giotto Troia of Distill talks about whether this is the pause for consolidation or the top out for craft brewing.
You know, I'm sure you've all heard a lot about the AB and Bev acquisitions and even Heineken buying up the rest of Lagunitas and whatnot. However, there is a lot of room for medium to large size breweries like ourselves to penetrate further into the markets that we're already sort of in, but a little bit more sparse. It's really hard for smaller breweries to start up and gain any sort of meaningful market share. So there's sort of the big breweries are finding it hard to expand further. The small breweries are finding it hard to build up, but the medium to large ones are finding that sweet spot where we can take away the bigger breweries' market share, because people are finding them to be boring or they're transitioning into other types of craft beverages, whether they be like the sparkling water with hard liquor or the hard sodas or whatever it is. And then the small ones, they're really finding it hard to beat out the breweries at our level, the medium to large ones. So
the choices are bewildering. You go into a Binney's or a Friar Tuck's or any decent liquor store that has a selection, and it's hard to make a choice. You guys are betting still on the IPAs and more on the sours. What are the trends in consumption?
Sure. So, you know, going into those types of liquor stores, you see a lot of the same things. You see a lot of the IPAs, and you see a lot of the fruited beers in order to a certain extent, set themselves apart. However, now they're part of a bigger club, you know. It's really important to consolidate your offerings in order to stand out a little bit more. Make sure that what you have is the best quality that's on the shelves today. So our sours, for example, that's really what became sort of our nationally known brand. We are distributed in 20 states plus DC, so there's a national notoriety there where we're offering sours in markets that a lot of breweries haven't even touched that style category yet. And we did it really before anybody in the Midwest had done it. That's what we're banking on, and we know through trends on the East and West Coasts, as we know in the Midwest, it takes a couple years for those to come in, maybe even more than a couple years. But we're taking advantage of it, and we're jumping on that bandwagon early, and we're offering that to the public as sort of a sneak preview of what's to come, because soon the market's going to be inundated with those, and then breweries that are on the cutting edge are going to look for the coasts again and say, all right, what's popular now? And that might be dunkel lagers. It might be wheat beers. It might be Hefeweizens. It might be something like that that, you know, we can jump on that a little bit early too. So we really look at it as sort of an ever-evolving trend, but we like to stay on the cutting edge of it.
What is the life cycle of American beer, craft beer drinkers' taste? Is it a 4-year cycle, a 5-year cycle? How fast do they say, you know, this has been great, but I'm looking for something just a little new?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't be able to pin down an exact number on that. Depending on the style, it might last a decade, it might last a couple of years, it might be one of those in-betweeners. It might even last longer than that. The IPAs, I think a lot of people thought they weren't going to last as long as they have, and I still don't see really an end to it. However, I do see people developing interests in other styles of beers, too.
Your initial production capacity at the new facility in North Normal is 25,000 barrels a year. You could grow to up to 150,000. Is that big enough to be able to capture the market share from the big boys that you referenced earlier without being small enough so that you find it difficult to make headway?
Looking at it from being in 20 states and D.C., that's a lot of markets to be in. We're currently sparse in a lot of states, but we're trying to penetrate deeper. So this brewery is going to give us the ability to obviously maintain where we've been and actually grow from where we've been at the old facility in Bloomington. However, it's going to give us the opportunity to fill out those markets. So 150,000 barrels, yes, doesn't seem like a lot when you're thinking about Sam Adams or when you're thinking about even Lagunitas or Goose Island or something like that, but it is enough to make our presence known in those states and even potentially open up more states to create more notoriety and then maybe fuel a build-out of a larger campus like we talked about before.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Giotto Troia of Distill Brewery. They're having a grand opening for their new facility in North Normal. Tell us the specs of the tap room and what people can look forward to in terms of food, in terms of beer choice, in terms of entertainment value.
Sure. It's a 6,300 square foot indoor beer hall, and then we also have an attached outdoor patio attached by garage doors, so it'll have that really open air feeling that a lot of people have come to familiarize themselves with when going to tap rooms around the country. But, you know, it'll have over 45 taps pouring our own house-made beer. We also have a 10-barrel pilot batch brewing system where we can brew, obviously on a small scale, experimental batches that, you know, we haven't brewed before or something that we maybe want to test out them in our tap room prior to sending to the market. So, again, sort of feeding into our national distribution model, feeding it into it as sort of a way of gauging interest prior to building out a huge production batch. But the tap room or the beer hall will also have a wide-ranging menu, although it'll be a fairly short menu. So I think there's 17 or 18 items on it, but it varies from, you know, terrine to a chicken sandwich to a burger to, you know, some other things.
Why choose that? I mean, craft brewing destination places vary widely in what they offer. Some are just straight-out brew pubs with a brewery attached. Surly Brewery in Milwaukee has a giant main floor restaurant, which is a basic restaurant, but they also have a gourmet restaurant where they offer different beer pairings with your cuisine. What went into the choice of a limited menu?
Well, we didn't want to offer an extensive menu like we do at our brew pubs in Normal and Champaign. The main reason for that is that those are a little bit more family-oriented, and they give the guest the ability to have beer as well. However, the main focus is beer. When you come to a beer hall, when you come to an actual production brewery, they come for the beer menu. They come for the brewery-exclusive releases and things like that. And then in order to stay a little bit longer, we want them to put something in their stomach, right? So they have the option to, you know, have food. So it's beer-focused with food available as opposed to our brew pubs, which are food-focused with beer available.
What about beer tourism in the craft brew trail kinds of approaches in the state of Michigan? A lot of them are within an easy drive of each other. You guys won't have that sort of synergy with other craft brewers.
Sure. So in central Illinois, you're right. There's not a very wide-ranging selection of craft breweries. You know, you go up to, or you go down to Champaign, and there's a couple of them, Triptych and J.T. Walker's, et cetera. Obviously, here in Normal as well, we have White Oak. However, we like to say that we want to serve the community that is sort of brewery barren. You know, there's not a whole lot of options out there. So having something like this that makes them feel almost like they're in a larger metro area, whether it be Milwaukee or the Twin Cities or even Portland or something like that, is something that is unique. And so we really wanted to offer the community something, but also Bloomington Normal and Central Illinois in general is a hot thoroughfare between Chicago and St. Louis and Madison and St. Louis, Milwaukee, St. Louis. It's not a hard drive from Chicago or St. Louis, so you can take day trips up if you wanted to. So we're really serving the Midwest in general as a not an end destination, but a very focused stop along the way. So we find that important as well, giving people a little bit of reprieve from the road.
What are you thinking will be your annual traffic through there?
Hard numbers, we're not exactly sure. There's not a lot of, like I said, there's not a lot of these within a short distance of us. There's also not a lot of metro areas in the Midwest, whether it's Chicago or Madison, that it's as big of a thoroughfare. So I think we're going to get a large portion of the population of Central Illinois coming to check us out because it is something that's a little bit unique. But we're also going to get a very, very large number of people that are just traveling through, maybe not even stopping in Central Illinois for the entire day and maybe not staying overnight, but stopping on their way through, you know, as a 2.5 hour midway point.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Opening this week with its grand opening is the new production brewery for Distill in North Normal. And with us to talk about that is Giotto Troia. You brought several beers with you. One of them is a wild sour, a blueberry goza. Tell us about that one.
Sure. So it is a Leipzig-style goza with blueberries. So the Leipzig style refers to the Leipzig region of Germany. They do have salty water tables. So in order to replicate that in the United States and, you know, specifically in Central Illinois, obviously everybody has their different water profiles in terms of the minerals available in them. But we actually add salt to it in order to replicate that style. It's very mild in terms of the alcohol content. It's about 5.2% alcohol, which is elevated but still fairly sessionable. You can have several of them in a sitting. It also is very light on the body. So although it's tart, and not everybody understands sour beers very well, or if they do, maybe they don't really like them. Maybe they do like them. It is a very polarizing style of beer. But it's very light on the body and very drinkable.
Speaking about polarizing, shandies and gozas and other lighter fruit additive fares or fruit brewed fares are growing in popularity. But, you know, the purists are going to say, barley, hops, malt, forget it. Anything else, forget it.
Sure.
What are the differences in the characteristics of a drinker of this to someone who is a purist? Is a person who is going to like a goza also going to access your sours, your sure. other sours or the IPAs?
Sure. So the first thing I would say is that it does have malt, water, yeast, and hops. it also, in this case, has blueberries in it, which creates sort of a tartness as well as a really beautiful sort of ruby-looking hue. However, the other thing I would say is that sour beers are pretty much the epitome of original. That is what they started with prior to people knowing that yeast was yeast and prior to even putting it in barrels. People would put these ingredients in the ground. They would naturally ferment through the use of bacteria and the local microflora, we call it, which is bacteria and wild yeast in the air. And then they would spontaneously ferment, and poof, you've got something that's going to get people drunk. That's what they found back in the day, and it wasn't until, I think, the 1700s where they actually cultivated yeast off the inside of barrels, and they were like, oh, maybe we should add this back into a beer. So there's a long history proving that sour beers were the way that beer was made. When people are purists and original people, they're not really purists. They're talking about modern brewing techniques. The reason that we have sours and the reason that sours have become widely popular and so polarizing is because it is a different style of beer. It's sour as opposed to smooth. It's tart as opposed to malty. It's not as approachable from all angles, I guess. It reminds you more of a sort of a cross between maybe a wine and a soda or maybe lemonade. It is a great summer beer. It's just not what everybody's looking for, I guess.
The other thing you've brought here in the Wild Sour series is syncopathic, and that involves dry hopping. Tell us what that does.
Sure. So syncopathic is actually on pace to become probably our most popular beer in terms of annual sales. The dry hopping technique is a technique of, after the boil, adding the hops in order to not create a bitterness, but to create more of an aromatic and flavor profile. During the boil, if you were to add hops, the hops actually break down and they create or they release what are called alpha acids. And as those alpha acids break down, the beer becomes more bitter. So the longer that an alpha acid is in the boil, the more bitter that beer is going to be. The less time that that alpha acid is in the boil, the more aromatic and flavorful that hop is going to become. And what that does is it really creates more of a juiciness and more of a, I think you were reading the can before and you mentioned, oh, it's piney. So it gives you more of that aroma as opposed to that lingering bitterness that, again, is very polarizing. IPAs are very polarizing. So that one is not only a hoppy beer, but also a sour beer that is a little bit more approachable from most sides.
What else have you got new that's coming?
We also have a summer seasonal called Amra. It's Sanskrit for mango, and it's Amra is a mango IPA, an American IPA, so it's a little bit more well-balanced. It's not quite as bitter, not quite as smooth. It's got more of a juiciness to it, and actually we used more tropical hops as well in order to pair well with, obviously, the tropical fruit.
You're not the only ones to do a mango IPA or a mango beer. What about mango works well with hops?
I think it really is the tropical flavor profiles and smells. A lot of hops, I wouldn't be able to name them off the top of my head, but a lot of hops do have sort of that pineapple-y and mango and sort of tropical essence to them, and these fruits really pair well. It's almost indistinguishable, really.
Distill's grand opening is May 27th. Gio De Troia is with Distill. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, an immigration story. Instead of letting old plastic bags clog our landfills or flutter around on the whims of the wind, a local group upcycling them to help folks in need have a place to sleep. Laura Kennedy has more.
Those plastic bags that you carry home from a Target run or your weekly grocery shopping are finding new life in the hands of some dedicated volunteers. The Normal Public Library is hosting a day of crocheting, May 27th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Hundreds of plastic bags will be transformed into waterproof sleeping mats for the homeless. Sylvia Hsu from the Normal Public Library says this particular craft event was inspired by another project called Scarves of Strength.
We had a bunch of women that volunteered and knitted a bunch of scarves and hats for women in the domestic violence shelters. And in talking amongst this group, they were really excited to be doing something like that, to be able to give back to the community. And they actually wanted to form a group that would do different kind of charitable things. And about a month ago, we also did hats for kids at St. Jude. So this was a natural fit for us.
So basically, this is almost like a club within the Normal Public Library of people who want to create things with their hands for people in the community.
Absolutely. Yep. We actually have a little name. We're calling ourselves The Circle.
Okay.
So, yeah, because it started out as a circle of women, you know, sitting around in a circle talking and crocheting and knitting. So it's a fitting name.
So taking plastic bags, you're taking plastic bags and you're essentially weaving them into plastic sleeping mats for the homeless.
Yep.
You know, this is actually a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is really huge. There's actually a Facebook group for people who actually do this.
Yep, absolutely.
So this is a very widespread event.
Right. We found out actually about this. One of our members, name is Christina Martin, does this for her church. And she was saying how she wishes she could produce a lot more of these, but it's time consuming to make the plarn. And
plarn?
So it's called plarn, which is plastic yarn. We're calling it plarn.
Okay.
She said that it's time consuming. And I offered her, I said, hey, that would be a great charitable event that we could do here at the library. Many hands, you know, makes the work a lot lighter. So yeah, this was actually inspired by her.
Well, how long does it take to make one of these?
Well, it's a pretty big stitch, so it's several hours. But probably the most time-consuming part is actually making the plarn, because the bags have to be folded a certain way and then cut and then attached together. They're linked together, basically.
Well, tell me how you looked into how this is a specific need that you're filling. How did you go about assessing the need for these mats from the homeless?
Well, I kind of keep tabs in the paper and so forth about different, like Home Sweet Home, for example. They have put out articles out there about there are a lot of homeless that do not come to the shelter to stay for whatever reason. Sometimes they don't feel safe. Sometimes, you know, it could be a mental issue or something, and they just don't want to stay at the shelter, but they definitely need things like this that would help them be able to stay in the places that they choose, like parks or whatever. So that's kind of where that came from. There is a need for it because there is a huge population in Bloomington Normal that does not stay in shelters, but that are homeless, that I've personally talked to and have seen. This is something that's really important to me, so I just kind of have been keeping tabs on it, if you will, throughout the years.
You know, how portable exactly will these mats be? I mean, for homeless people who basically, you know, have on their back or carry in a bag all their possessions, is this something that's easily roll-upable and just stuffed into a bag?
Which is really cool, because considering that it takes 600 bags to make one, you'd think it would be super heavy, but it's not. It's very light, and it does come with straps that you can tie up the mat, and then the straps are also used for, like, putting them over your shoulder, like a shoulder bag. The way it was designed is very convenient.
600 bags.
600 bags.
Where do you get, and for that's just for one mat. Where are you getting these bags?
Well, it was really cool because we reached out to the community, the patrons of Bloomington Normal, and whoever else wanted to donate. They came in and they brought so many bags, which is really cool. Yeah, and then a lot of the employees also brought bags in. But I'd say the community responded well, because I really feel like it's a win-win situation. We get to recycle the bags.
It's good for the environment.
It's good
for the homeless people.
Exactly. Yep.
Have you thought about maybe hooking up with one of the local grocery stores and have them actually donate some of their bags?
That's our thought for next year. Absolutely. Because I would like to make this a yearly event, if not bi-yearly. And I was going to reach out to the grocery stores and ask them to donate bags. It'd be a lot easier that way, because we wouldn't have to bypass a few steps of having to go through all the bags, clean them out.
How many do you estimate you'll be able to get done?
Well, it all depends on how much plarn we can make. Let's see. It takes 600 bags. I wanted to make 30, so we're looking at 12,000 bags. We have a lot of bags, but
where do you store those bags?
Well, they're kind of taking over the copy room at the library. So they are, it's a huge, huge amount that we have. Hopefully, I'm hoping for 30. But if not, whatever we can make, you know, I'm sure will be helpful.
How well do these mats hold up over time?
Well, they're pretty sturdy, and they're crocheted, actually, really tightly. So I'm thinking that they're going to hold up. Now, I've never personally have slept on one, but they do look pretty sturdy. And actually, we have one hanging up in the library if anybody wants to come out and kind of check it out. It's pretty neat.
Well, as you said, Sylvia, this came out of other projects mm-hmm. that the women in the circle have done mm-hmm. to help people in the community. Mm-hmm. Are you looking to the future and other things that you could be doing for folks in the community?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if anybody has any ideas, please reach out to us at the library. You can go to asknormal.org and they'll be able to leave us an email or whatever. And
are you going to have a big ceremony or something where you hand over the mats to like Home Sweet Home or what have you and say, you know, here's our gift to you?
That's not in the works, because it's almost like this is something that we've done kind of quietly.
So do you not want a lot of attention for the fact that you're doing this?
Attention in the fact that people should come help, but not necessarily attention in the fact that, I don't know.
You don't want pats on the back for doing
exactly.
this.
Exactly. That's a perfect word for it. We're doing this out of a heart that wants to help the community and give back to those that are less fortunate. And absolutely, this is not about acclamations. It's not about praise. It's about helping out.
That's Sylvia Hsu from the Normal Public Library. Crocheters can join the circle on Saturday, May 27th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The Normal Public Library isn't the only organization that crafts mats for the homeless. First Baptist Church in Bloomington does ongoing work creating and crocheting mats from grocery bags as well.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Not all immigrants come to the U.S. illegally, but every one of them has a compelling story to tell. Those are among the messages immigration advocates hope to get across at a panel discussion this evening at the Bloomington Library. Members of Bloomington Normal's East Indian, Mexican, Caribbean, and Latino communities will share their personal stories. GLT's Judy Valente sat down with one of tonight's speakers, Marianne Taylor, who emigrated 6 years ago from the Dominican Republic to the U.S.
One of the main things that we want to accomplish is for people to actually hear the stories of immigrants, actually hear from their own mouth. What was their experience? Why did they came here to the United States? What are their passions, their dreams, the things that they want to accomplish? So how can you be an ally to them? How can you hear from their stories and relate to them?
Well, tell me a little bit about your personal story. How long have you been in the United States, where you came from, and what prompted you to come?
For me, and this is something I was thinking the other day, for me, immigration is love. And that was my reason for coming here. It was because of love. I was living in the Dominican Republic, and I was also traveling internationally to Africa, also going to Haiti. That's like right there, our next door neighbors. And I was working with several people and several organizations as well. Social organizations, yes, and some of them religious as well. I met my husband when he did a mission trip to the Dominican Republic. And then, like I say to my friends, he was the photographer of the trip. I was the interpreter of the trip. He took too many pictures of the interpreter, and he decided to bring her home. He didn't want to photograph. He wanted her.
did you have difficulty then coming to the United States because you were not married initially?
No. Well, the process for me, I went through the immigration project that is here in Bloomington Normal. They're a great organization that they really, really helped us. So my story might be different to others, but in my case, what we did was we got married through the court here in the United States. I went back home, arranged everything for us to have the wedding there with my friends, my family back home. And then I came back here and we completed all the paperwork and I became a resident short after.
Your story is really a remarkably swift one of being able to come here with legal status. That's not what happens to a lot of people.
It's not. It's not. My experience was, I can say, was very different from other people. I have shared my story with others. It's like, wow, that happened. And even the timeline of how it happened, from the moment I submitted all of my paperwork to the moment I got my green card or my permanent resident card, it was about 3 months.
So what is it that you would like people to understand about immigration, people who are not immigrants, people who are born here in this community?
From my standpoint, I came here because the doors were open to me. I met my husband and we wanted to start a family. We wanted to be together. So I came here to be with my husband.
And just clarifying, he was an American.
He is.
Born in America.
He is a citizen. He is a born citizen. His parents are as well. I know that my brother and my sister came here looking for better things, more opportunities for them to advance. Both of them completed their colleges. They had degrees and they wanted to be able to use them in a greater way to improve their family.
Were they able to come here legally, though?
Yes, they did. My sister-in-law, she was a resident, so she came here. And then my brother came after she was here. And then my nieces are both citizens. So when my brother came, he was in the process of becoming a resident. In the meantime, she was getting her citizenship. So that was the path that they did.
So your family is coming here going through the process legally. What is your feeling about people who jump the line, as you hear people say, jump the line? They come before they've gone through the process. They've come illegally without their documents. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, what can I say? this is the way I did it. And the opportunity, I wasn't, in the beginning, I wasn't even thinking I was going to be living in the States in the first place. So it was something that happened, and it was a love story in my case. But I know that many other people, I have heard their cry. I have heard the situations that they go through. I work with many of, how you say, illegal immigrants, people that were just trying to find a better life, people that in their countries, they're going through situations that are very hard. They don't have a food to eat. They don't have a place to stay. They're dealing with a lot of violence where they live. They're dealing with a lot of situations that makes it very hard for them to raise their family in a good environment. So I met many of them, great people with a compassionate and hardworking people, and they just wanted a better life.
What's the solution for them, though? They're here without documents. Mm-hmm. They're under greater threat now than in the previous presidential administration of being deported.
I'm not a politician, so I might not have your magic wand for you to tell you this is the magic thing, that this is going to solve all the problems with immigration. I know that it's very difficult to tackle. I know that it's very so many things that you have to consider to it. But in everything that you have to consider, what is not being addressed in this political environment right now is the lack of love. Where is the compassion? Where is the, if that would be me, what would it be of me? Would I, if something, God willing, doesn't happen here, then and we have to go to another place because here there's something going on that makes it very hard to live. Do we want people to welcome us? And I go from my own beliefs, and my beliefs tell me that I need to hand my hand to the neighbor. I need to help them. Those that don't have to eat, provide them. Those that don't have something to dress, give them something for them to clothe themselves. So my personal belief is that whatever you do, it has to be with compassion. It has to be rooted in love. It has to be rooted in what if that would be me.
Part of the inspiration for this panel is to help people see how they can be quote-unquote allies to immigrants, both legal and illegal. In your opinion, how can people be allies?
Just by going there, they're showing that they're being allies. If they go to that meeting and they hear the stories and they put a face to the rhetoric that is being mentioned, some people think that way. They're just like, oh, it's just like a parasite. They just want to suck. No, that's not what they're coming here for. They're coming here to give. They want to give of their knowledge, the things that they need to do. They want to work hard. And I know for a fact, because I was working in a Western Avenue as a translator, and I was working with many of immigrants here, and they're hard workers. They're trying to find jobs. They pay tax. They do this. They do that. They're doing things to improve where they are.
Marianne Taylor is a translator and interpreter. She's also involved with many of the outreach efforts of Center for Hope International Ministries here in Bloomington. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Tonight's panel discussion, Immigration, the Local Story, begins at 6:30 in the community room of the Bloomington Public Library. The discussion is free and open to the public. The conversation is being sponsored by the Immigration Project, a legal advocacy group, and the political action groups Indivisible Illinois 13 and Indivisible Illinois 18.
Once upon a time, there were some eager gardeners who wanted to make something grow.
I planted roses.
I'm growing heirloom tomatoes.
Purple coneflower for me.
And they each ran into problems along the way.
Ew, black spots.
Wilt, so much wilt.
Is this supposed to be brown?
But I helped them out with that, and now their gardens really grow. My name is Murph. I can help you too. Send in your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a 50th anniversary party for a famous, famous record. The rate of positive workplace drug tests is going up both nationally and here in Illinois. But a closer look at the numbers finds some drugs show up more often in various parts of the state. IPR's Sean Crawford talked with Chicago Tribune reporter Alexia Elejalde Ruiz, who examined the results.
Quest Diagnostics, which did this study that showed, you know, kind of that positivity rates on drug tests have been increasing, did a really handy map that looked by the first three digits of each of zip codes to see where the types of drugs that were coming back positive in different parts of the state. Heroin, for example, right around Rockford, it's you know, lights up at more than double the Illinois rate, nearly four times the national rate. There, for example, it's pretty heavy. Also in the south suburbs of Chicago and around Kankakee County are also kind of heavier use there.
And do we have any idea of why that is the case, why that seems to be more prevalent in those areas?
I don't know, because I cover the workplace and I don't cover drug policy or drugs, so I really have no idea.
And of course, cocaine, that's something that doesn't get as much attention these days, but that also is prominent in a lot of these drug tests in certain parts of Illinois.
Yeah, that's been growing quite a bit. It's reached a 7-year high nationally as far as positive cocaine tests at the workplace. And in Illinois, you see it, you know, greater rates of it, again, in kind of the Will County area, southern Cook County, and in the Kankakee County area. Rockford also has high rates of cocaine tests coming back positive. Also, around Sangamon County, which is where Springfield is, also has high cocaine rates.
And then in Sangamon County, for example, marijuana, which is still, I believe, the one most likely to come up in drug tests, that's showing up even more in areas around Sangamon County, which is, of course, the seat of state government.
Right. I thought that was interesting. I don't know why I kind of assumed that marijuana would light up, you know, maybe in Chicago or in more urban areas or something. But it's pretty even kind of in around Chicago and Cook County and Lake, kind of the north central areas. It's pretty steady at marijuana, positive marijuana tests. But then Sangamon County kind of lights up as being the only place where there were more than 3% of marijuana tests came back positive, whereas in the rest of the state it was, you know, below that, kind of just around 2%, which is both the Illinois and the national rate.
I know some are saying that marijuana use is gaining more acceptance. Laws have been changed, things like that. Maybe people don't view it as dangerous. Is that part of the problem here, part of the reason why we see more of this?
You know, it could be. As, Illinois, we have, you know, medical marijuana is legal for a pretty limited number of health conditions. But nationally, there's been quite a few states that have adopted recreational marijuana as legal. And so, yeah, so there's the idea that perceptions are just changing and tolerance for marijuana use are changing. So maybe employers aren't, so don't get all bothered, you know, if employees test positive for the drug. Also, marijuana is notoriously stays in your system for a really long time. So it might be that, you know, just employers just aren't as concerned about it. That's kind of anecdotal. I haven't seen any kind of studies that show that there's a greater permissiveness. Some of the people who I spoke with for the story said that general trend might be making more people come to work with marijuana in their systems.
From an employer standpoint, they may see these numbers for different drugs in different parts of the state. Does that change how the businesses may look at these tests and what they look out for when it comes to hiring somebody?
Yeah, I mean, the people who conduct these tests say that it should, that employers should be alarmed and that they should be on guard because, I mean, the reason this matters is for safety reasons, right, and post the kind of workplace culture, but also so safety, especially in safety-sensitive positions. And the test results also show that there's been an increase in positive tests for safety-sensitive positions like pilots and bus drivers and truck drivers and things like that. So, yeah, so it is something for employers to keep an eye on to kind of see what is going on. There was another study that came out earlier this year, which was interesting, about employers waking up to the fact that drug use happens, you know, among their employees. For a long time, it was just something that kind of employers put their head in the sand about. And it's a huge cost to the business, just as far as absences and productivity. So there's a bit of a push to get employers to wise up.
And I think I read in your article that the rates, positive test results, were down for years after being pretty high in the 80s. They have dropped quite a bit in the last 30 years or so, but we've seen this trend in the last few years. Is this more drug use? Is it better testing? Is it both? Do we know?
That's a really good question. It might be both. So yeah, so in the 80s, when they first started tracking this, at the late 80s, it was 14%. Positivity rate. So 14% of drug tests were coming back positive. That plunged down to about 4% in the 2000s. And then just over the last 4 or 5 years, it started creeping back up again. Now it's at about 4.2% overall. So still way down from what it had been. So yeah, it could be different, testing methodology, better testing, but also there's the marijuana, trend that we talked about. And then there's the opioid crisis, right? That's been huge. As far as more people getting addicted to prescription drugs. One of the interesting findings also is that opioids have seen a decline as far as positivity rates in the past few years, but there's, at the same time been an increase in heroin rates. So, it's a question of have people who got hooked on prescription drugs, have they been turning to heroin, which is cheaper?
It seems like in typical jobs nowadays, there may be drug testing at the start when somebody is first hired, but may not happen much or at all after that time. In some cases, maybe these numbers could be a little bit low in the sense that people know to avoid drugs when they're going to be tested. And after that, it may change.
Yeah, I would think that people definitely know to keep themselves clean when they're being hired for a job and then let their hair down a little bit as it goes because they don't expect it to come back around. But also, a lot of employers who do drug tests at the beginning at the hire find that so many applicants come back positive that they have to just look the other way, or they have a really, really hard time finding positions because marijuana use in particular is just so prevalent. And like I said before, kind of sticks in your system for a long time. Even when you can prepare for it, people seem to be showing up with marijuana in the system anyway.
That's Chicago Tribune reporter Alexia Elejalde Ruiz talking with IPR's Sean Crawford. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the release of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album. GLT's John Norton made a stop at North Street Records in Uptown Normal to talk with store owner Jeff Wilson, whose love affair for all things Beatles has been burning for 40 years. Another installment of our regular feature, What's on Your Turntable?
A lot of people say, kind of almost like Nirvana changed music in 91 with the release of Nevermind. The Beatles changed it in 67.
Yeah, it's amazing that just a couple years before that they were doing Love Me Do.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it was Lucy in the Sky. And what a mind-blowing album. I can't imagine hearing all those records that you love and all of a sudden Sgt. Pepper shows up. It had to blow people's minds.
Well, on the 50th anniversary of the release of Sgt. Pepper, let's talk about some interesting quirks maybe about the album cover itself. You want to start with some of the music maybe?
Well, a lot of people maybe don't realize that the Beatles recorded everything in mono. And when it came time to do a stereo mix, they weren't even present. It was George Martin, Jeff Emmerich, and a guy named Alan Parsons, the tape engineer. When it came time to do that stereo mix, there was no way to duplicate exactly what the Beatles did. For a month, they did over 700 hours worth of recording sessions, getting that mono mix exactly the way they wanted it. And then came time for a stereo mix just for the hi-fi enthusiast. And the mono and stereo mixes are drastically different because there's no way to duplicate it without the Beatles being there and telling them all the nuances. So the mono version has a lot more punch. The stereo version has got a lot more space, but it's really cool that there's the same album is so different.
Did the Beatles as a group care if it was mono or stereo? Did they have a preference?
No, they really, when they first started recording at EMI, that's the way they did it. Everything was mono.
Yeah.
And they just kept doing it because they just were used to doing it that way. And once again, the stereo mixes back in the mid to late 60s were kind of an afterthought. Most teenagers had a mono record player, so the mono records sold a lot better. And not to mention they were a dollar cheaper than stereo records. At one time, Lennon even spoke in an interview about Sgt. Pepper, said, "You haven't really heard Pepper until you've heard it in mono." The mono mix has everything in your face, whereas in stereo it pans back and forth and it kind of hides stuff. All the special effects and all the... the echoes and all the different limitations or limiters and filters and all the things that they did in the studio kind of went out the window when it was a stereo.
Well, let's take it to another track on the album. Do you have a track that you can give us a little tidbit that maybe some of us might not have known how it was recorded or a little behind-the-scenes take on the song?
I always like Getting Better. It's a real rockin' song. It's one of those things where you can tell John and Paul are writing a song together. It's getting better all the time. It's kind of positive by Paul. It Can't Get Much Worse is a little, acidic from Lennon. It all kind of bounces around like that, you know?
I've got to admit, it's getting better. It's a little better all the time.
We've talked about the album cover in the past. Let's cover that a little bit as well. There's so much going on here with all the faces that are on there, all the references to Paul being dead. Can you take us through a little bit of the backstory on that?
You know, they already had artwork. There was an artist group called The Fool, and they're the ones that painted the Apple Boutique building. Anyway, they had an album cover all designed for them, and one of the photographers came up with the idea of how about if you get a real, you know, artist that's well-known or whatever. So a guy named Peter Blake designed the whole thing. They were a band called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. They weren't the Beatles anymore. And all the people on the cover were people that were very important in one way or another, whether they be a comedian or a world leader or a religious figure. At one time, they even wanted Jesus, Hitler, and Gandhi on there, but of course that was vetoed because it was a little too controversial for 1967.
You wouldn't think Jesus would be controversial, though.
Well, the reason that was is because about 6 months before that, Lennon had made the statement, we're bigger than Jesus, and that whole thing exploded, so EMI didn't want to touch that with the 10-foot pole.
I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go.
Oh, there's Madame Tussaud's wax figures of the Beatles on the cover. And that's the Beatles watching Sgt. Pepper also, you know. Not to mention, a lot of people, I don't know if they've heard the death clues about Paul McCartney. You know, there's always this rumor that he died in 1966 and they started putting things on the album covers to allude to his death. And if you look at the front cover of Sgt. Pepper, there's a couple of things that are unusual. The word Beatles is in red, and that's supposed to be Paul's grave. And if you look at the yellow flowers that look like a guitar...
Just says, to the right of the Beatles there, right?
Yeah, it says Paul ? On it, which is kind of unusual. I think it's all coincidence, but it is kind of weird. Right above Paul's head, there's a hand that's kind of blessing him like a religious person would. There's a little car on the doll's knees, the Shirley Temple. It's a Shirley Temple doll that says, "Welcome to Rolling Stones." Well, the little car on there is supposed to be the Aston Martin that Paul died in. On the back cover, Paul's got his back to the camera.
And he's the only one with his back to the camera.
He's the only one with his back to the camera, and he also appears to be a lot taller than the other Beatles. But one thing about the cover, too, you know, there's all that death clue stuff, which I think is bull, but it is kind of weird that all this stuff kind of coincides with it. It's bizarre. I don't believe it, but sometimes I wonder.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock as the day begins. Silently closing her bedroom door.
Can you give us another little backstory on something about the album we might
not
know about?
The Sgt. Pepper album cover is one of the first album covers to ever print the lyrics. Most records had inner sleeves that advertised other label albums. You know, when you bought a Capitol record, it'd have all the Beach Boys and Nat King Cole records listed on the inside, too, to help plug those albums also. Well, Sgt. Pepper actually had a psychedelic inner sleeve and a poster with cutouts, little pictures and badges and things like that. I'm also really glad that they've reissued all that stuff. You know, since 2009, a lot of the Beatles stuff has been remastered and redone and repressed on vinyl because everybody loves records again. And the fact that you can buy a mono record for about $25 is great because most mono LPs are way out of print, really expensive. And usually when you find them, they've been played so much that they're not worth buying. The new Sgt. Pepper box that's going to come out, and it's going to have a completely remixed version of the album. George Martin's kid, Giles, has done it. I don't know if it's Giles or Giles. But either way, he's also done a 5.1 mix of it that's going to show up on a DVD in the box set. So it's really kind of like a quadraphonic type version of the album.
Okay. I'm at North Street Records in Uptown Normal. I'm John Norton with Jeff Wilson, the owner of North Street, and our go-to expert on all things Beatles. It's the 50th anniversary of the Sgt. Pepper release, and we're just having fun listening to the album. What's another song you want to talk about here?
Well, maybe we ought to just play Within You Without You. You know, it's one of the first times George kind of dabbled in Indian music and all the darubas and tablas and all that kind of thing. Really a psychedelic piece of music, you know. Let's play that.
So So I have a friend who for years has said the Beatles ruined rock and roll. They killed rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And the Sgt. Pepper album especially.
Everybody's entitled to their opinion, of course. But Sgt. Pepper is one of those records that's so influential. You either love it or you don't. You know, it's like it's so influential and it's such a beautiful record, but at the same time, it really changed music. You know, it was no longer "You Really Got Me" and "I Can't Get No Satisfaction." You had to really kind of, you know, you really had to start thinking about music, and music made you think. You know, it started kind of becoming more important than just a little pop song. It's more of a culture thing, you know.
Who were following the Beatles after this?
Well, you know, even the Rolling Stones started doing records like the Beatles, you know. Satanic Majesty's Request was their psychedelic record, but it wasn't, it just didn't have the same punch as Sgt. Pepper, you know. It just seemed like they were kind of imitating him. But they did the same thing with, you know, Beggar's Banquet. It was kind of a white album, and Let It Bleed and Let It Be, and, you know, there's a lot of comparisons with the Stones.
How about a final thought?
Well, I can't believe it's 50 years old. I can't believe all Beatle records are starting to be 50 years old now, you know. It's like, well, I guess it's almost like the world's classical music, you know. Especially Sgt. Pepper, that's so iconic.
Well, Jeff Wilson at North Street Records, it's always a blast playing music with you, but especially when you got Beatles on the turntable.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff. Love doing it.
A Day in the Life by the Beatles from the Sgt. Pepper album. It was 50 years ago this week the iconic album was released in America. Thanks to Jeff Wilson of North Street Records in Uptown Normal for sharing his thoughts on one of his favorite albums. What's on your turntable? Drop us a line at WGLT.org or at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Thanks to John Norton, Laura Kennedy, and to Judy Valente for today's show. This is WGLT Normal.